I thank you, Bill. Water coming there. Okay. Get my watch out. Well, good morning, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. It's great to be here today at the this conference. I agree with what everybody's been saying. It's been a wonderful collection of speakers, and it really just has been a pleasure to sit back and absorb the perspective that I got from each of the speakers. But Tom, I don't know where you are. You overdid it last night and blew the power grid, and we're not too happy. You just got to tone it down about 1,000 watts, and we'll be all right. I read the 24-hour day book every day. I'm going to read what was in there today. Sunshine is the laughter of nature. Live out in the sunshine. The sun and air are good medicine. Nature is a good nurse for tired bodies. Let her have her way with you. God's grace is like the sunshine. Let your whole being be enwrapped in the divine spirit. Faith is the soul's breathing in of the divine spirit. It makes glad the hearts of human beings. The divine spirit heals and cures the mind. Let it have its way and all will be well. And the prayer for the day, I pray that I may live in the sunshine of God's spirit. I pray that my mind and soul may be energized by it. I just thought that was an amazing coincidence that that was today's reading, considering the theme of your conference. And so I just wanted to share that with you. I was thinking about, sometimes I think about what I'm going to talk about, and as far as I got last night was the name of the talk. And then we'll fill in the rest this morning. And the name of the talk is Spirituality 102. And the reason I chose Spirituality 102 is I knew that nobody would listen to a 101. Because it would be too basic. And those of us in AA, you know, we want to get a little more advanced. So I know that was what I would be attracted to. So that's probably my own analysis of things. But before I get to that, there were two stories, two experiences that I had in my drinking life. That'll be my qualification that I wanted to share. And then I really do want to share with those of you that are new what I think some of this spirituality is in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first story is for Wayne. Because when he was talking, I just said, God, this story has to be told to Wayne. And this story happened to me in 1952, and I've been drinking about 2.5 years, and I was a junior at Yale University up in New Haven, Connecticut, and I had gone from a very good student into just about flunking out. No more athletics, getting in fights, getting arrested. I remember coming into AA and I heard a speaker one time. He said, we got people in here from Yale to jail. And I didn't think that was much of a spread. Since I had been both at once. And so I was, just getting into alcoholism, but just so taken over my whole life. It was just, I never knew what was going to happen when I drank. But Smith College, which is a lovely women's school, girls' school, I don't know, it's probably co-ed now, but anyway, they would have these exchange dances and invite a bunch of students to drive up. So I went up with my buddies. And, sometimes, do you ever have a weekend when you drank and you didn't do anything by accident sometimes? You know what I mean? You really couldn't explain it the next day, but you said, God, I wish I could do that all the time. I just drank and drank, stayed polite, didn't throw up on anybody, you know, just no fights, no nothing. And somehow I managed to do that weekend. And in the course of the weekend, I met this wonderful girl who was incredibly beautiful. And her name was Mary Alice Bush, from the Anheuser-Busch family of St. Louis, Missouri. She was the granddaughter of Augustus Bush and was, you know, right in the straight line for the inheritance of all of the Bush stuff. And because I had behaved myself, she liked me. And I remember the guys on the way back, they said, boy, if you marry her, you'll never have to work again, and you can have all you want to drink for the rest of your life. And I remember thinking that, God, that is wonderful. What a great weekend. And then, by pure luck, I again went up to Smith and didn't get in trouble. And so I felt pretty good about things, and I said, would you like to come down to the junior prom, which is the major event? Yes, I would love to. Well, I came back down there and said, Mary Alice Bush is coming down to my junior prom. Wow! I mean, we were excited about all this, and so on the day of the thing, I started getting ready early. Her train was coming in, I don't know, at about 2 in the afternoon, and I started drinking gin around 10 in the morning, just sort of getting ready, and I was still functioning when I met the train and took her over to the hotel, and she's getting ready, and there was a dinner party out in the Brantford area, and I just, this white tie, putting on these tails, and I'm just whistling along, but any of you were there, you'd go, this isn't going to last very long. It's going to be a very short evening. You could see that I had just gotten way ahead of myself, but I was still going along and, you know, got up, got there, and somebody else was driving, and we got in the car, drove to the hotels, picked up the dates, and off we went to this dinner party, and it really looked wonderful. And we're at the dinner party, and I'm having a few drinks during dinner, and I think it was right after dinner, I started having, you know, remember when your mind short circuits right before you pass out, and you just kind of, and you're coming back, and those were starting, and I went, God damn, you know, I remember looking at my watch, I'm not even going to get to the dances, you know, it's just, Jesus. So I said, maybe some coffee. So the coffee came around, and I think I had the cup in my hand. No one was looking at me. They were all talking somewhere. And the electricity went off. And the cup spun around on my finger. Dumped in my lap. And I came back. I came through again. So if you weren't looking, I was still sitting there with the cup on my hand. On my hand, just like I had been 1 second earlier, except it was empty now. And I remember just going, oh, God, is that hot? I put the cup down, I started to say something, and boom, I'm out. I mean, I passed out cold. So my friends told me later, you fell on the floor, you'd passed out, and so we started dragging you in the closet just to get you out of the way. And somebody said, what happened to him? Well, he must have had too much to drink. Look at that, he passed out. Look at that, he wet his pants. So I'm in the closet, and they go off. But you know us alcoholics, this night is far from over. We haven't done enough damage yet. I mean, we got to make this a weekend that Miss Bush will remember and remember and remember. God, I would love to find her someday and hear her version of that weekend. So I guess a couple hours later, I just kind of woke up around. I knew what had happened, and they were gone. went in the bathroom, dried it off as much as I could, cold water in the face, and went out and started hitchhiking into town. And by God, somebody came along relatively shortly and picked me up, and it was cold, and I was getting more sober and more, you know how you just sort of get it back together again. So when I got to the gymnasium where the prom was, I walked in and sort of had it all together and came in, and she was dancing with somebody, and I came up and tapped him on the shoulder and said, "May I cut in?" And she turned and looked and just was like, "I don't believe, I think I had some food poisoning, and but I'm fine now. I'm so glad I got here," and all that. And so I was given, it was sort of a funny look, but I was given the benefit of the doubt. Okay, dancing. Things are going extremely well. Have a drink, dancing. Have another drink, dancing. And I'm dancing around, and I look over to the side of the gym. We were in the basketball court. And I see on the side of the gym about a 20 by 30 foot doorway to another prom. And I remember just looking out of the corner of my eye going, "What is that? Do the seniors have a prom? I didn't know there was two proms here tonight," and I'm dancing. I'm not saying anything to anybody, but every time I go by, I'm looking in there, and they've got a ball, you know, with the light reflecting, and Peggy Lee was singing, and I thought I could see her in there. So I came around the third time, and I was about as far as I am from that wall, and I said to Mary Alice, "Stay right here, I'll be right back." And I took off to run into the other room. It was a mirror. I never broke stride. I just boom, I'm down. I'm bleeding from a bloody nose all over me. She's standing there in a state of shock, you know. So a couple of my buddies carry me out into the coat room, and they're putting ice on my nose, and they're going, what happened? I said, "I don't know." I said, "Other dance was in there," and I ran in there, and there was another guy running out. I tried to move, and boom. So they're explaining, no. And I'm going, "Oh, my God." So I'm lying there having a few more drinks. And a friend of mine from Dartmouth that I grew up with was down for this. And I said, "Marty, God, how good to see you. Come on, let's go get a drink." And we go over getting a drink. And I said, "Have you ever seen this gymnasium? This place is amazing. I got to give you a tour." So we're touring, going up in the elevator. Here's the fencing room where, you know, we got the fencing things. And we're just going into everything that they had in there. And we ended up in this crew room where they practiced the single skull rowing. I'd never seen this room before, but I'm explaining it to Marty. And I said, "Marty, this is where we practice rowing and all that." I said, "What they have is a big valve over there. When you turn it on, the water creates a lot of pressure, and then you row against that." I'm going to get in there. I'll show you what I'm talking about. So I had the one oar, you know what I mean? I had the two oars. And I sat in this little seat, and I said, "Turn on the valve, Marty." And so the water just came rushing out and knocked me in right out of the boat. So now I'm soaking wet with cold water, and it sobers me up, and I go, "God, Mary Alice." So I run over to the mirror, and I just get, you know, paper towels and just do whatever I can. Sort of get it all together and come back on the dance floor and walk up and tap the guy and go, "May I come?" And that was the last I ever saw of her. So I ended up having to work for a living as a consultant. So that was early in my alcoholism. And then when Tom was talking last night, he woke up under the table in that bar, and he's looking through the thing, wondering where he is. And it reminded me later on, after I was in the Marine Corps, and I was finishing my first tour of duty overseas in a fighter squad, which was very exciting, but I got in a lot of trouble, and I won't go through all that. But I had my orders back to Camp Pendleton, California. I was going to be with the infantry and be a forward air controller. And we went to Yokosuka, Japan to check out to fly back from Haneda. And the guy in charge there said, "Now, you guys stay in the BOQ because you could be alerted for a bus up to the plane you're on in an hour's notice. So don't be screwing around and leaving and going somewhere where we can't find you. You're going to get in a lot of trouble." Yeah, you know. So, after about 8 hours, I'm going, "Well, what the hell? How long are you going to hang around a damn room, you know? And this thing, we could be here for weeks." And the rest of the guys are going, "Look, we got to stay here because it could have, we could go over to the Oak Club, get a beer, come back. That only takes 10 minutes. So I started testing the limits of this boundary. And I'm over there and this and that. And finally, I decided I got to go back into Yokohama one more time and say goodbye to everybody down there, all the bar owners and all that. But I'm going to just stay an hour and I'll be right back. So I went down, went around, came back in an hour. And everybody's still there. And, of course, they're going, "Do you realize you're risking your whole career?" I mean, the rest of the people are like, "What? How could you be doing this?" And, us alcoholics, "Well, I can't sit around here forever. I mean, how long am I going to wait?" So we were there a day. So the next day, I said, "I'm going to go back one more time. I'm in town, and you know what happens." I wake up. That's it. I wake up, and I'm looking around. I've never been here before, you know, and I'm just looking around. And I'm in a little octagonal room. You know what I mean? It's just like, I'm going, "What a weird room." And I'm looking at curtains have all sailing stuff on them. And there's like a wrought iron spiral staircase over here. It goes down somewhere. And I'm lying there in my dress uniform thinking, "Well, where am I?" And then I can hear people talking down below. And then I kind of peek over and I go, "God damn, I'm in the front gate of Yokosuka Navy Base. This is where the officer of the day sleeps up above, and the shore patrol's down below. And there are people going in and out of the gate. It's the main gate. And I'm sleeping in the officer of the day's bed." And then I go by a mirror and I see there's a note pinned to me. And I go, "Oh, Jesus." So I take the note off. It's from the officer of the day. And it was, "Lieutenant Beach, you are a disgrace to the uniform of the United States. A cab drove up at 4 a.m. and you were passed out in the back. You were thrown up on the back seat. The driver was furious. He wanted his money. You fell out in the street. We had to carry you in. And a little while ago, they sounded the message for your group to go back to the United States. They've already left. When you come to, you jerk, you report to Admiral so-and-so for blah, blah, blah." And I'm going, "Oh, man, that's a..." That's a tough note, you know what I mean? It's like, So I come down the little thing, and the shore patrol guy's, "Good morning, Lieutenant." Ha, 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 ha. And I just went, So I went back, and I got my stuff. And I was sitting there, and there was some beers around. I had a couple beers to just calm down so I could think. And all of a sudden, I just went, went up to the back to the gate, and I said, "What time did that bus leave?" And they said, "Oh, it's been an hour and a half." I went back and I called a cab. and the cab came, Japanese cab, and I signed my own orders out of Yokosuka, got in the cab and went to Anita, and got there, and I'm looking around for the guys, has the flight left or, you know, whatever, so I bring my orders over, show it to the guy, and he said, oh yeah, your flight leaves in 2 hours, go over there, you got to check in with the, if you're bringing, what you're bringing back to the United States, then you got to go over here, fill out these forms, then put all your baggage over there. So I went over and I filled this and I filled that and went over there, put all my stuff. I got a hamburger and a beer, and I'm sitting there when the bus arrives with the rest of the guys. And they come in and I go, okay, guys, you go over there and you check in. And then you put your baggage here, and here's the forms that you're doing. And of course, they're just going, what is this? And I never heard anything about it. I can't imagine. So anyway, I think those stories do qualify me as an alcoholic. And at the end of my drinking, I ended up in a mental institution. A corpsman in there came in one night and said, all drunks fall in, and marched us to an AA meeting. And when I got there, I thought it was exciting. The guys that talked, it was a speaker meeting, made it sound wonderful. And I could tell that they really were happy. And I remember thinking to myself, if I ever find a guy with a drinking problem, I'm going to send him for these guys. It was like, it's just wonderful what they have. I can see how excited they are about it. And but it wasn't me. And so I had to go through one more episode of drinking as an outpatient and smuggling booze back into the nut ward. And they told me if I ever drank again, my career was over. And I knew they were going to get paranoia, started coming back. And I could see the psychiatrists were looking at me funny. Remember when your drinking really kicks in and you start feeling weird? Everybody's watching everything. And so I knew they were going to get me. And so that's when on Pearl Harbor Day of 1964, I called AA from my home. And the guy came over who's my sponsor, Bill Terwilliger. And I just spoke at his 40th anniversary last weekend. And we've been together this whole time. It's great having a sponsor that long. You both have to stay alive. That's the only way to do it. And he came in and just, God, it's the exact same thing that Harold's sponsor did. Get in the car. Get in the car. That was all it was. And I wanted to explain myself to him. And, no. We don't need anything about from you. Just get in the car. And off we went to this meeting, and it lasted forever. It was a group anniversary. They had square dancing and food, and they were there till 11 at night. And I just got it on. The meeting started. I've been sober 4 hours. The meeting got over. I've been sober 9 hours. You know, it's like, and I need a drink bad. And I knew, you know, God, yeah, it's wonderful and all that. And it was an Al-Anon lady who really saved me. I was thinking of running away from the meeting. I had all I could take of people coming up going, hi. It was just like, I don't want to see people anymore. I just want to run. I want to get out of here. But it was freezing cold. December, and it was sort of misty, rainy, cold. I'm standing outside, and there was no street lights near this old Oddfellows Hall, and I'm going, which way should I run? You know, just, I gotta go. You remember that when you just had to go? You didn't know where you're going, but you gotta move. And this lady came out and put her arm around me and said, it's gonna be all right. And there was something in her eyes that made me feel that she was right. I don't know. It's just amazing. I got to know them later on. Their husband and I were good friends. But that just at that night, her putting her arm around me and saying it's going to be all right, fixed something inside of me. And I'm eternally grateful to Betsy Lynch. Anyway, I didn't drink. And I haven't had a drink since that night. And that started this journey into Alcoholics Anonymous that has been just remarkable when I think about it. So when I think about talking to those of you that are new, you know, about spirituality, you know, I can see if I was new and somebody goes to spirituality, I'd go, I'm going to time this mother and be out of here. I want to hear some drinking stories and do some laughing, and then we'll get out of here and get on our way. And so I think it's important to understand the difference between spirituality and religion, because all of us may have had some bad experiences with religion. I had a terrible experience with religion. It wasn't the religion's fault. It's just I saw it that way. And I had a spiritual experience in the Catholic Church at about age 8 or 9. I took literally everything they told me. Literally. Boy, when those nuns said something, "You will rot in hell forever," I went, "I'm going to rot in hell forever." I mean, it was like, yeah, it was just boom, black or white. There was no middle ground. And I was seated on the front pew one Sunday morning, staring at the crucifix, which was 20 feet high, hanging from the ceiling. You just couldn't miss it. And as I stared at it, I was suddenly given a vision of truth from somewhere, a personal vision of truth. And the truth that I got all by myself was, "Do you see this crucifix, little boy?" "Yes, I do." "Well, this is what God did to his only son that he loved. Guess what he's going to do to you?" And this was my own personal, it only didn't happen to anybody else, just me. I had this secret communication from God that came into me. And I fainted. That was so overpowering, and they carried me out. "What's wrong?" "I don't know, something I had for breakfast," and you know, but that stayed with me a long time, that little thing. So I never got comfort from thinking or talking or anything to do with God. It was just like, boy, I got to postpone that as long as possible. Just live to be 300 if you can, because it's going to be bad. So that was sort of the thing. And so when we talk about religion, we talk about welcome to our church. We're going to tell you, we have this history book here. This is where Buddha came from. I want to show you some statues of Buddha, and this is how it got started, and these are the messages that came down. And when I get to explaining it all, then I go, "Do you see? Do you see? I've explained this to you. Can you believe in that? Or in a different religion, can you believe in this?" And so the presentation is made about a historical set of events. And then you go, "Yeah, I see. Yeah, I'm going to believe in that." So that would be religion. But spirituality isn't anything like that. Spirituality is nothing more than a group of principles. They're called spiritual principles. And they just have been around forever. And if you go into almost any religion, you can find the same set of principles that we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So what they are time-tested principles that will enable you to see the world differently so that you're happy living here. And you're very comfortable. And you go, "Wow, the world finally makes sense. Now that I can see it this way, wow, I'm comfortable here. I like it here." And that's what spiritual principles are. Now, they put us in touch with something that causes this to happen. It is a power of some sort. And in AA, we go, when you get in touch with that power, you can call it anything you want. That'll be up to you. But you will experience this. You will have a different way of seeing the world, and it will occur from the inside out. Nothing out there will be changed. It will occur from the inside out. And you know, a lot of alcoholics go, "What? That sounds like mumbo jumbo magic." You know what it sounds like? Drinking. Do you remember why you drank? You walked in to cause the world to look different from the inside out. And when that third drink kicked in, you looked around and you went, "I like this place. I like this place." And that was the same place you were when you had no drinks. Remember that? And you walked in, you said, "I can't stand the world. It's awful. There's all these people. They're out to get me." Blah, blah, blah. 1, 2, 3. You know what I like? I love the world. And I love the people in it. I love all these people. Buy them a drink. Yay! People are wonderful. I love it. I love it. I love it. So why would we be the ones to doubt that a power can transform the world that we live in? We did it every day. Only that power didn't like us. That power was killing us. It just killed us. So we were on the right track. We had the right idea, wrong higher power. That was the only mistake we made. We were on to something. And, we were on to the fact that you're not supposed to be able to live on your own. You need something beyond yourself. And we seem to know that. And we just got off down the wrong road. So that's what spiritual principles are. They just are. And Alcoholics Anonymous, and geez, again, Harold was talking about that Members' Eye View. If you're new, read that pamphlet. That's just so powerful. There's nothing new in Alcoholics Anonymous. These principles are around forever. The one thing that appears to be different, that is the reason AA seems to work, is that the presenting of these principles is done on a horizontal plane. We normally are used to people talking to us this way. The judge is up here, and we're down here, and we're getting the message. You are screwed up, and you got to do that. Mister is up there, and he's going here. So we always have the feeling that we're down here, and the message is coming from way the hell up here. We come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and the message is coming eyeball to eyeball from another person just like us. Another damn drunk. And that seems to be one of the magic things about AA, that there's just one drunk passing it on. There's nobody in charge. That you can't move up to anything in AA. There's no, you can't get anywhere. There's nothing you can do. The highest pay grade that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is servant. That's it. And it takes a lot of work to get there, because you start out as big shot. And it's a long way from big shot to servant. A long way. That's called a spiritual journey, to go from big shot to servant. And that's what we're trying to do, is to go from that self-centered to servant. And so what we need is a new frame of reference. That's what I want to try to do today, is to, we say old ideas avail us nothing. But the old ideas that we all have, is that's our frame of reference of what the world is, who we are, and what's going on, and all that. And you put it together yourself as a kid growing up, and a lot of that frame of reference was necessary in order to survive what you survived. You know, you got to get even with this. You got to, don't get too close. Don't trust this. Whatever it was, you used it, and that was good because it got you this far. But that's a very uncomfortable frame of reference. Most of us learned a bunch of things. I learned, like, in that church, that scary thing. Well, that was my view of the world. Well, it's got a punishing God that's going to get me later on. And then there's my mother. She was very ill. I didn't feel like I was loved. So, well, if your parents are terrible and they don't love you and you can't trust anybody and blah, blah, blah. So I had all of this stuff. And as long as I stay with it, it's always going to be uncomfortable. And so I remember reading a book called The Seven Mysteries of Life by a guy named Murchie, and it was really a wonderful thing. It took about 20 years to write it. It's all about planet Earth, and he's just one of these guys that can explain everything, and he does. You know, how a tree grows, how the leaves turn to do this, how the desert is really alive, how the whole planet is really alive, and how sand dunes move, and they go from here, and they go over there, and there's a whole pattern to it, and rocks, and they start up here, they go in the ocean, they go back up. And how every little creature, he goes to, you can see little pictures and all of that. So it's almost like he just has explained life, what all of life is. And one of the mysteries is divinity, that after you get through all of this stuff, there's no way of not accepting divinity in this, that it just has to be part of it. So his final conclusion, after he takes you through this entire thing, is, what is planet Earth? And he said, planet Earth is a soul school. That's what planet Earth is. It's where we send souls to the spiritual part of us to go to school. And we come here and we're going to have to learn some lessons. And so if we shift our frame of reference and just say, okay, so I was sent here to go to this big school, and I'm going to be given a lot of lessons. And it changes how I'm looking at things, and we start seeing things differently. Now, how do we get somebody to get interested in this school? Well, we have to cause something to happen in their lives that will transform them, that will cause them to listen to what I'm saying today and what you hear at AA meetings all the time. And that is generally done by adverse circumstances, like going to a nut ward. And when you get admitted to the nut ward, you don't see it as the best thing that has ever happened to you. You have no way of seeing it. How many of you may have gotten here through the DWI program? And you're out there driving around in your terrible alcoholic life, and you're drunk again, driving around. And he pulls you over, and he sticks his head in, and he smells your breath, and he says, "Get out of that car!" It's hard for you to see him as a spiritual messenger. Who is taking you out of the wrong direction that you're headed with all the wrong perspective on life, and it's going to put you over here. It's hard to see that until later on you get a chance to reflect on it and you can see it as clear as a bell. How lucky it was that I got pulled over that night, because then it led to this and then it led to that. The other thing that occurred to me, and then I can get going on with what I want to say, is Chuck C. A lot of you have heard Chuck Chamberlain. This was one of the greatest speakers in AA and a great role model for how to live the spiritual program. And he did that men's retreat, and they took the tapes and turned it into a new pair of glasses. It's a transcript of that retreat. It's a very, very powerful thing. And I heard him talking one time, And I remember afterwards I said, "Did he say what I just heard him say? He couldn't have said that." So the next time I saw him, I went up and I said, "Chuck, the last time I heard you talk, it seemed to me that you said this. I want to see if I got it right. You said, you know that old saying, God takes care of those that take care of themselves?" He said, yeah, I remember saying that. "Well, I said, you said that that's totally wrong." And he said, "It is." That's why I just wanted to get that sure. I just wanted to make sure that that's what you said. He said, "Oh, yeah, that's absolutely wrong." He said, "This is the deal. It is not your job to take care of yourself. Stop doing it. That's God's job. Stop worrying about your problems. Stop trying to take care of yourself. That's God's job. Your job is to do God's will. You are just a servant of God. Just do the next right thing. You will be taken care of." And I remember just going, "Whew, that's mind-blowing. That is, I mean, you talk about changing your frame of reference from a soul school and then to, it's not my job to take care of myself." And I remember going, "You know, Chuck's right." That's the only way to be spiritual, but just in case he's wrong, I'm going to keep all the money I have in the bank, and I'm not going to get too damn generous with it, because I might, this spirituality might take over, and I'd give it all away to the poor, and then... Half measures avail us nothing. You know what I'm saying? It's such a revolutionary picture. But that's what he's saying. That's exactly what he's saying. And then the other point I wanted to make, and then I'll talk more about just some of the stuff that's happened to me. A lot of times we say to new people when they come in, "You know what your problem..." Well, there's a couple things we're to use. there's two sentences that follow up on, you know what your problem is? Do you ever have people talk to you that way outside and judges are calling your mother or your wife or your husband? You know what your problem is? They're always pointing their finger at you. Your problem is you don't give a damn. Your problem is you're irresponsible and you drink too much. We're always being told what our problem is. When we come in AA, we finally get rid of that. We just aren't doing that until this morning. And so, you know what your problem is? Lack of power. That's the only problem you have. That's your problem. Lack of power. You're not a bad person. You didn't do anything wrong. Just lack of power. You've been overpowered by life because you were trying to live it on your own. You were trying to survive on your own because somebody told you you're supposed to be able to survive on your own. And we got these ideas. Oh, a real man makes it on his own, makes it on his own, makes it on his own. And people do. They go all the way up and they become millionaires and they're 50 years old and they commit suicide because life doesn't make any sense. What have I done? What have I accomplished? It was that we were trying to accomplish it on our own. And the other thing that we sometimes say when we're new is, you know what your problem is? You're out of touch with reality. You're totally out of touch with reality. You know, that's so true. We're absolutely out of touch. We don't know what's real. And we come in here and we start plowing through those steps and they take reality and they take our nose and they put us into that until you can't miss reality. Wow, you see everything. And it seems to be overpowering, but we learn all of the truths about ourselves by going through those early steps. They just are there to make sure that we're totally in touch with reality. But spiritual programs are paradoxical. They're very paradoxical because watch what happens as we move towards the steps at the end. And we start talking about living life in the now. We start talking about living life as a loose garment. We start talking about becoming unself-centered and simply a servant of a higher power so that the ups and downs and the vicissitudes of life have no effect on us because there's no ego to hit. It is a freedom from the world. And so in a literal sense, the second half, the spiritual part of the later steps, is an attempt to totally get out of touch with reality. Isn't that ironic? I don't want reality to be hammering me anywhere. I want to be in a different level. I want to see the world differently so that somebody crashing into my car is just a car that needs to be repaired. You follow what I'm talking about? It's just... the reality is that something awful didn't happen. You know what I'm saying? That was the old reality. Look what happened to me, this terrible da-da-da. And now it's just, oh, the car needs to be fixed. It is just, there isn't anything to be hit by this stuff because of this place that the later steps can take us. And so that just occurred to me recently that is really what the goal of spirituality. It is the same thing we did when we went drinking. I just can't stand all this stuff. And we got lifted to a different level of existence. Bill calls it the fourth dimension of existence. And it sounds, you know, like, where could I be? What is way up there? The fourth dimension of existence. It is a simple path that we took, and Harold was so right. Just the beginning of your talk, I'm going to listen to that many, many times, is that we already are all that we can ever become. Now, does that sound... What? We already are all that we can ever become. We're a beautiful, perfect child of God. We just think we aren't. You see, when we arrived here, we've had this experience when you come to the soul school. You see, before we come to the soul school, we probably have perfect contact with the higher power. And it is so exquisite. It's absolutely wonderful. And when we come here, it feels like we've lost that contact. Many of us talk about there was something missing in our lives. You remember that feeling, there's something missing? You remember this story about it? There was a 4-year-old kid, and he went into his 1-year-old brother, and the mother heard the 4-year-old talking to the 1-year-old, and the 4-year-old said to the 1-year-old, who can't even talk yet, said, "Tell me about God, it's starting to fade." You know what I mean? It's starting to fade. Well, you know, we don't know that's happening. We're here in this world, and we're just looking around. We go, well, it must be that nobody changes my diapers. It must be that nobody took care of me. It must be this. No. We're getting the illusion that we're existing as a separate entity from God, and that we're all alone, that we're a human being just out here in this thing, and what's it all about? And it takes a disease of alcoholism. It takes, you know, in William James' Variety of Religious Experience that Bill Wilson talked about as one of the books he read, and it says that people who have these spiritual experiences, which is the transformation, so you now have a new vision of the planet that we're living on, all had one thing in common. Something bad was happening to them. You know what I mean? Not just alcoholics, but all kinds of other people. Something bad was happening to them, causing them to totally surrender, and then a whole new vision took place. And so, as you start seeing it, if you're new, you're going, you know, it was good that I got fired. It was good that this happened to me. How many times we look at somebody who's a practicing alcoholic, and they, you know, they get a DWI, but the judge lets them off. And you go, damn. You know, everybody else. Hey, no, damn. Because if he'd just done that, then he might have had to surrender, you know. And then his boss calls him in and promotes him. And you go, oh, God. If he just fired him. I mean, so, you know, when you're looking at it from the program side, you want something bad to happen so that something good can happen. It's just... Well, everything is kind of backwards as we're trying to move forward on this thing. And so, in my own case, it was so hard to let go of the old way of seeing things. You know, it sometimes felt like I was a pair of binoculars, and I was locked in to the close-up position. You know what I mean? I could only see stuff that was right here. And what you want is the big picture, you know, so you turn the thing on the binoculars and they go, oh, wow, look at all that. I like that. But the seawater has rusted that together. And it is quite a painful thing on the binoculars to change that perspective. And the same thing with us. To go from the material perspective to the spiritual perspective is painful. And that's what Step 7 talks all about. Humility is accepting the fact that this transformation is going to be painful and eagerly going into it, because we understand the value of doing this, that when I come out the other side. So what? Why is it painful? Why would it be painful to go from this perspective to that perspective? Because this perspective is self-centered. I see the world as from me. I see it right here. And as I see it, I generate something called my way. You know, I look at it, I can feel the problems I have, and my way is, I need money. I mean, there it is. It's that simple. I mean, it's anybody who was inside of me would see that I need money. Remember that when you're new, you just go, money, money, money. Where's the loan step? Where's the loan step? I want the loan step. And that's it. And if somebody were to say to me, we can get rid of your financial insecurity without money, I would go, what? How could that be done? How could you get rid of it? Oh, you wait and see. You'll just be free of it. And so I was told, and I'll say this to those of you that are new. You know all the problems that you have? You know all these things you're thinking about, that you're worried about? They are already being worked on. Okay? They're all of them already being worked on. So just relax. Don't work on them anymore. They are being worked on. You come in here and work on these steps. Okay? And just leave them alone. They're being worked on. That's not yours to do. You just come in here and work this. Work these steps. Because when we get to the end, what do we get when we get to the end? We become unself-centered by becoming God-centered. And when we become God-centered, we now see the world as it really is. We are the same as the people who thought that the Earth was the center of the solar system. And when they looked around, it didn't make sense. You remember that? As they said, well, if this is the center, How the hell can that be moving that way? That's wrong. It can't be. And so we're going, I'm the center. Well, everything's screwed up. I look around. I can't stand this planet. It's awful. So I got to go from being self-centered to God-centered, and that is a very painful process because it involves never getting my way. Never getting my way. I have to get rid of my way in every aspect of my life. I have to have no way that anything has to be. And I don't know about you, but the only problem I ever have is not getting my way. It comes in many forms. It comes sexually, financially, job-wise, health-wise. I'm sick, and I don't want to be sick. See, it may be this painful to be sick. It's this painful to not want to be sick. I can't stand being sick. Well, what have you got? Oh, a little headache. Little headache is 5 units of pain. Not wanting the little headache is 250 units of pain because we're willful and we don't want it to be this way. And serenity comes from not having a way at all. Not having a way at all. I don't have a way about anything. It's just, that's not my job. It's not my job to figure out how things ought to be. That's God's job. My job is to get near to God. That's called conscious contact. When I am there, there are no problems. So in a spiritual world, problems don't get solved. You think they have to get solved. How about they get removed? That's what happens. When nothing else matters, who cares if I didn't get paid this week? I'm happy without money. I'm so happy I can't stand it. I'm so happy I'm just going to go over and buy this guy lunch with my last dollar. Because I'm not worried about that stuff. I already have everything that I could ever possibly want. I'm not sitting here worried about anything. Then I go, you know, this spiritual stuff is crap. I'm going back to the... And that's what happens. We watch television and they go, are you buying into that spiritual shit? You've got to stop that. You got to own a Jaguar. Now, you don't own a Jaguar. It's just an illusion that you're happy. Oh, yeah, I forgot that. Holy cow. Those damn AAs were brainwashing me. I got to get a Jaguar. And that's why we have meetings, so that we can come back in and our sponsor goes, no, you don't need a Jaguar. Because one day, you're going to fall off the track, and I'm going to put you back on. And the next day, I'm going to fall off the track, and you're going to put me back on. And so we need to come in. This is totally counterintuitive. All of the spiritual stuff is counterintuitive. It's just, you won't think it up on your own. It's just, so we need each other to keep reminding ourselves. First things first, meaning we must address our spiritual condition first and see if from there anything's wrong. And it is absolutely amazing. So if you're new, your problems are being worked on right now. A job is being arranged. Work on yourself spiritually. When you work on yourself spiritually, you transform the energy flow inside of you from all get to all give. And when you go on your next job interview as an all-give person, they can hardly wait to hire you. Man, do I want an employee that is all-give, who comes in and says, I'd like to see what I could do for your company. You want me to do that? I'll be glad to do that. You want me to do that? I'll even paint the ceilings. I just want to see what I can contribute to your company. Now, you want to hire him, or do you want to hire the guy who says, let's talk about sick leave, and let's talk about my retirement, and let's talk about I don't want to work overtime, and let's talk about everything that I'm going to get. Well, sir, I might call you tomorrow. I mean, you can just feel the different energy flows. And in the one case, I'm already taken care of, so the job is just an opportunity to be useful. And that's what Bill says in the foreword to the 12 and 12. What are the 12 steps? A group of principles, spiritual in nature, that if practiced as a way of life will remove the obsession to drink. Remove. Didn't say it would figure out why you're an alcoholic. It just said it'll remove it. The problem does not exist for you today. There is no such thing as an alcohol problem today. and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And that's in the foreword to the 12 and 12. That's what the spiritual principles are for, to remove problems and to enable us to be happy and usefully complete as spiritual human beings. So this is God's will for us to be happy, joyous, and free. So if I'm not happy, I'm doing it wrong. That's what I tell people. You're not happy? Oh, you're doing it wrong. Oh, you don't understand. I have this terrible life. Nope. That's got nothing to do with your terrible life. You're doing it wrong. I don't even care what problems you're talking about. You're doing it wrong. It would be like somebody came up to you and said, you know, I drink all the time and nothing happens. What would you say? I'd say, let me watch you drink. That's preposterous that you're saying. And you know what? He's a sipper. Sip, 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 and rotate. That's not it. Watch. Now you do that. Hey! Now, why do I know I'm right? Why do we know we're right about that? We know the power of booze. It's that simple. We know the power of booze. You pour enough into somebody, boom. Well, we know the power of spirituality. It's much bigger than booze. It's much more powerful than booze. And so, if we're not reasonably content, then we're not close enough. That's the only problem we have. It appears to be a financial problem. It appears to be a health problem. It appears to be all these other things. But it's really, we're too far away from a higher power. Somebody cut us off in traffic. We got a resentment, and the resentment immediately cuts us off from God. Now we're all alone. Now we're back out there by ourselves, and they overpower us. And then we go, I can't stand this world. It's all blah, blah, blah. And you go, you got unplugged. You know, there was one time in a movie scene, they're visiting a guy in the oxygen tent, and one of his visitors steps on the oxygen hose. And after a while, the symptoms underneath the tent there. And they call the nurse, and they're like, get the doctor. Look at all these symptoms that are going on in there. And then somebody goes, oh, I'm stepping on the oxygen hose. And all of a sudden, all these symptoms go away. Now I'm better. And so we get cut off from the spirit by any one of these character defects. Just boom, cuts us off. And then we manifest all these symptoms that get diagnosed as, well, he's got this, he's got a relationship problem, he's got a money problem, he's got a health problem, blah, blah, blah. And then we go, oh, somebody stepped on the God hose. Let me get that. Whoop. Goodbye health problem, goodbye relationship problems, goodbye money problems. Hey, how are we doing? I'm fine. I'm doing good. I'm doing good. I'm fine again. This is where it's at. It's there. But it never looks that way. So we need each other. We desperately need each other to constantly remind ourselves, first things first, put your spiritual contact first and all the problems will disappear. They only exist because we're feel that we're separated. So we use each other to stay close. And I felt very close here this weekend. There was that awareness that there is, in fact, something bigger than all of us. That the channel got open, the prayer of St. Francis, make me a channel of thy peace. And let me just close with this on that, the thought about that prayer. When I first read that, I saw that sentence, make me a channel of thy peace, and I went, I love that thought. I'm going to get these character defects out of the way. This channel's going to open up. And this wonderful peace from God is going to flow in and cover me with this wonderful feeling. And then years later, I realized that isn't it at all. That isn't even close to what it looks like. I'm going to work these steps. I'm going to get the character defects. The character defects are nothing more than blockages between you and this spirit flow. They're neutral. So don't even feel guilty you have them. They're just there, and you've got to get them out of the way so that you can have this wonderful flow. But the flow doesn't flow in. It flows out. It flows out from it. It's already there, all this peace. But it's like the Dead Sea. Until it flows out, I can't feel it. And so that's why the rest of the prayer says, you know, make me a channel of peace, that where there is sadness, I can bring love. That where there is darkness, I can bring light. That where there is error, I can bring truth. So that all of this comes out from us. So all of this is already inside of all of us. If we can't improve on it, we can't make it better, it's already perfect. We just got to get access to it. And you can see that when you are out helping somebody, you are experiencing a flow that you can't get in any other fashion. It's been a pleasure to be here today, and God bless you all.